Welcome to the Armour Men's Health Show with Dr. Mystery and Donna Lee.
Hello and welcome to the Armour Men's Health Show. I'm Dr. Mystery, your host, joined as always by my co-host, Donna Lee.
Hey everybody, welcome to the show. Thank you for listening.
We've been delivering this show and wonderful content for a good number of years, and you can get it on the radio as well as on our podcast. How do people search for our podcast, especially with the spelling?
Well, they can, that's right, you spelled armor incorrectly. It's A-R-M-O-R, but it's armormenshealth.com. That's our website. Or you can listen to our show live on KLBJ, News Radio KLBJ at 3 p.m. in Central Texas.
And so we've been delivering this show. We love all the content, all the guests, and all of your questions. How do people send us questions or visit us as patients?
You can reach out to our website for your questions that we'll answer anonymously every time on this show. It's armormenshealth.com. There's a little button at the top right that says submit your question here, and you can see Dr. Mystery and my smiling little sweet faces right there. And then you can also see us as patients in Round Rock, North Austin, South Austin, or Dripping Springs, Texas, y'all.
So although we started that practice, you know, I come from an era in which a practice is really like a family.
Mm-hmm.
And every person that joins becomes like, you know, a cousin or
like a brother from another mother.
Or a brother. And so I have a brother from another mother joining us today.
That's right.
Dr. Lucas Giacometis. Lucas, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, my brother.
Dr. Giacometis is a board-certified urologist. He is the fourth person to join our practice as a urologist. He's been in practice for a great number of years. Dr. Giacometis, why don't you give us a little background on your education and kind of your career route?
Well, it all started out in a little hamlet called Houston, Texas, where I was born and raised and educated at Rice University. And then I went up to the
Valedictorian at Bel Air, first of all.
Tied for first. There was a bunch of us, but that's okay.
There you go.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how I roll.
I was never tied for first.
It's all gone downhill from there. But no, it was a great school, Bel Air High School, Fighting Cardinals. Then went to Rice University. Our football team was okay, not too bad. And then up to Dallas for University of Texas Southwestern Medical School.
And you went there for a residency as well?
And residency as well. So
and
the Dallas
so you
decade.
Spent you spent 6 years or 5 years there?
It was 6 years of residency after 4 years of medical school.
That's right. So back then, that's when, you know, men were men and urologists spent that's 6 years doing urology residency. It's a little shorter now, thankfully.
Yours was six too,
and
right?
That's right. And then you went to work, and then you spent the majority of your career at Baylor Scott & White.
Correct.
And then decided to come into private practice. And you know, you see probably the most number of new patients of anybody in our clinical practice. What are some of the common things that you see people coming to a urologist for that you treat?
Well, I think people do think as a rule that we see more men than women, and I think there's some truth to that. Men coming in for erectile dysfunction, it's always interesting to see how they call us and schedule an appointment. They don't exactly want to tell their whole problems on the person answering the phone and say, hey, here's what I'm coming in to see.
Right, because it's they want to be private about what that is. And I think that if you're calling and really don't want to tell us what you're coming in for, you know, an annual checkup is a great way to kind of put that on the list. Obviously, offering online scheduling opportunities gives you a little bit more, I don't know, you don't feel as embarrassed saying it. But we do it day in and day out. So ED to us is, you know, as common as a ingrown toenail would be to a podiatrist.
And possibly this worse, yeah. You know, guys have urinary problems, of course. Women get urinary tract infections and actually a slightly increased predisposition to stones, as you know. So we do see a fair amount of women as well, and certainly incontinence.
Now, when it comes to urinary incontinence, you've been treating it for a large number of years, and stress incontinence in particular is something that you've had a special expertise that you've developed. Well, why don't you tell us why women develop stress incontinence, and what are the symptoms, and how is that different from urine incontinence?
It's so nice to talk about women on this show.
Ooh, I was going to say,
you know,
the change. Nice
those
change.
Born women at birth, you know, it's fantastic. Yeah. But for women, I mean, just to paint a broad brush, you know, we classically think of incontinence as urge incontinence and stress incontinence, whereas urge incontinence, we think, okay, maybe just an overactive bladder, you try medications, and now we have Axonix in our office as well. And then stress incontinence, sling, something, you know, when you cough or sneeze and laugh, and that's when the leakage happens.
And that's a big difference. I mean, pathophysiologically, what's happening in the body, leaking when you're coughing and sneezing is different than leaking when you can't get to the bathroom fast enough.
Correct. And I think women have a component of both, honestly. So you have to kind of tell them ahead of time, hey, we're going to treat this. Sounds like it's more of an urgency picture. Let's go this route versus let's start talking about stress incontinence and surgeries or even pelvic floor therapy as we offer too.
So when it comes to stress incontinence, what are some of the risk factors that you see the most common to cause stress incontinence?
Well, clearly childbirth. I mean, you know, when you have three or four kids all weighing 9 pounds apiece, you know, that's just a matter of time. And I think that some of that runs hereditary. I think women who leak will beget children. Is that right? Beget. Make babies English. That also leak in the future.
And what's happening physically is when the uterus enlarges and the baby gets into the pelvis, all of those muscles and nerves get stretched. And this is the support structure that's keeping all these organs up. And when these support structures get weak is when they descend or drop when you cough and sneeze and leak.
That's right.
And so we offer pelvic floor physical therapy. How do you explain to patients what pelvic floor physical therapy is and why it helps?
Well, I think a lot of years ago, I think women had a concern, and rightfully so. There were a lot of bad slings, bad mesh out there, and a lot of the, you know, lawyers on TV advertising it. And I don't think that's true. I think there are some bad products out there, but certainly we would never willingly put them in people. So I think when people look at us and say, hey, what can I do that doesn't involve me going to surgery? Then, you know, pelvic floor therapy certainly sounds good. And I don't think it takes away the need for it. I just saw a patient that I did a Bulkamid procedure, something that's not quite as aggressive as a sling. And she had a little bit of leakage afterwards, and then she did pelvic floor therapy. And I think it really helped her out, just something as an adjunct to what we do. But just basically like you're going to the gym, except down there.
And it may not sound like it makes complete sense, but this pelvic floor muscle is like a basket that holds all of your organs up. Men and women both have them, and they both cause a lot of dysfunction. Women have several holes in this pelvic floor, one they poop from, one they pee from, and then one that goes around the vaginal canal. And so when that muscle gets weak around the urethra, you can certainly start seeing a lot more incontinence with stress, cough, sneeze, and pelvic floor physical therapy, which we offer in our office, can be very helpful. You mentioned Bulkamid, and so that's Bulkamid. So maybe explain to our listeners, what is Bulkamid, who is the right patient, and what can you expect from the procedure?
I think when women look for an option, it's still only available for women right now. They're getting indications for men and the right scopes for it. But basically, the best way I describe it is you're creating a damming effect. You know, so you're injecting this product in the walls of the urethra just to make the hole a little bit less big. So when the gushing happens, you have a little bit more of a control over it. And I try to explain to them that this is not something that necessarily will work forever, although I've been very impressed with the longevity of it compared to its predecessor, some other products that were like it. You're looking at a 10-15 minute surgery. And in fact, you can probably do it in the office. I haven't done Bulkamid specifically in the office, but it really doesn't take much to do that. And so I think when women are looking for an option that's not quite something permanently implanted, a sling, a mesh, you know, these conceptions that it's terrible, and then that's a perfectly good option.
Yeah, I think that for me, this Bulkamid option is good for women who are leaking maybe a precautionary pad or one pad or less a day, mainly when coughing or sneezing and are looking to avoid kind of a bigger operation like a sling. But we do slings.
We do slings.
And the mid-urethral sling still remains the mainstay and gold standard for treatment for stress urinary incontinence in women. What sling do you do?
Well, I like to brag that I did the first mid-urethral sling in the city of Austin.
Nice.
That's true. No, most people don't know that. And she did great. And I guess because I never heard from her again, or she's out there yelling about how terribly leaky she still is. But that was like 14 years ago. And the way I describe it, it's like a little hammock, you know, so if you cough and sneeze and bear weight, you're looking for some support. Now we have a little camera so I can make a little hammock noise, but something to give a little bit of support underneath that urethra to create a back resistance so that you give yourself a little bit of time to catch it and get to the bathroom in time. And I do it and it takes me about 20 minutes to do it.
I do the transvaginal tape sling that involves 3 incisions, 1 in the vagina and 2 in the suprapubic region. I think that for me, that works out better. There are slings that come out through the thighs, the transobturator tape, and there are some that are just single incisions that get pinned into the muscle. Which one do you use?
Well, yeah, you're right. Let me preface that. The mid-urethral sling, the first one that was done in Austin, was the single incision right in the vagina, no other incisions. I remember having one lady that I did thigh incisions, and she ended up with a huge thigh bruise. I'm saying, why am I making these big incisions on their thighs, and that's nowhere near where I need to go? I've used the Solix sling, the Altus sling. You know, they're all fine products. Before that, it was a mini arc. You know, very good products overall. They've never been recalled.
On this, on this show, we frequently talk about how the bias of your surgeon will significantly impact the bias of the treatment you get. So if you go to a urologist that doesn't do slings, you're going to be, you know, non-operatively treated for the entirety of your disease process. So make sure you try to find a surgeon that specializes or at least has an interest in the disease process that you're going to them for. Don't assume that all surgeons are the same, because they certainly are not. Lucas, thank you so much for joining us. He is a partner at NAU Urology Specialist. Donna, how do people make an appointment with Dr. Giacomides and get on our schedule?
You call us at 512-238-0762 or visit our website, armormenshealth.com. Thank you, Dr. Giacomides.
Thank you.
Hello and welcome back to the Armor Men's Health Show. I'm Dr. Mystery, your host, joined as always with my co-host, Donnelly.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to the show and sharing it with all of your friends.
Yeah, we would appreciate you sharing it with your friends. Mm-hmm. When we have listeners that come into the office, they are well primed to understand what holistic urology is all about. Mm-hmm. They understand that they're going to be offered not just surgical options, but also non-surgical, sometimes some holistic options. You're going to be offered counseling on dietary and supplement alterations that we want you to make. You're going to be given the latest and greatest in regenerative options, and really a real aim to care for the whole person, not just the things between the nipples and the knees.
That's right. I think holistic urology, too, is such an interesting buzz phrase that we've created, because I've interviewed lots of urologists around the country and they're like, what in the world does that mean?
Yes, because it's, you can make surgery. This job, you can make this job very trained monkey, or you can make it elegant trained monkey.
That's
one
right.
of the two.
We like elegant trained monkeys.
How do people become our patients?
You can call us and learn all about the elegant trained monkeys at 512-238-0762. Our website, as you well know, is armormenshealth.com. And we are in Round Rock, North Austin, South Austin, and Dripping Springs, Texas, y'all. So be sure to reach out to us. We're here to help.
So once again, we're joined by one of the partners at NAU Urology Specialist, my brother from another mother, Dr. Lucas Giacomides. Thanks a lot for joining us, Lucas.
Thank you, Armando.
So when it comes to our, you know, mutual treatment of patients, we certainly do a lot of things the same. We do some things differently. But I kind of wanted to explore your treatment algorithm and how you counsel patients that have been diagnosed with prostate cancer that we know has been localized to the prostate. So you're diagnosed with prostate cancer. What are some of the things that you think about and talk about when you're discussing treatment with a patient?
Yeah, it's a good question. I usually see about one or two new diagnosed prostate cancer a week, and in a perfect world, I'd like to see them at the end of the morning or the end of the day. And you know, sometimes it's just not feasible or practical to do. But then sometimes I just realign my whole schedule, because I don't think it's a quick, easy, yeah, you've got a kidney stone, let's go get it out kind of conversation. It is complicated. A lot of the cancers that we see are pretty straightforward. You say you got a kidney tumor, you got to take it out, or the whole kidney, or you got a bladder cancer, take it out, or the whole bladder. A testicle cancer, you take it out right away. But a prostate cancer has lots of flavors. So, you know, about 15 years ago, we were all challenged by the lay press to say we are doing way too much prostate cancer diagnosing and treating, and we're mutilating men, and we should never, ever check PSA.
Because the idea here is that most men that are diagnosed with prostate cancer will never die from it. But some men with prostate cancer
That's
do
right.
die from it. And it's our job as the gatekeepers to try to figure out who those people are and then advise our patients as best as we can.
That's right. And what I tell them, you'll never know which one of those you're going to be unless you get a biopsy. And you never know if you're going to need a biopsy if you never check your PSA. So these are very easy tests to do. And I like to think that I let people make the choice after I tell them, hey, here's your pros and cons of doing something. So when I get that diagnosis, I think it's important to say, okay, standard biopsy, maybe 12 cores. We take 12 little pieces of the prostate out one by one. And, you know, how many of those came back positive for cancer? And then how aggressive they look on a microscope?
Because that's what you can tell, not just whether you have cancer, but how much, where is it, and how aggressive it looks like. And if you do an MRI beforehand, we can even get a more targeted biopsy with an MRI-guided biopsy.
Right. And I think it's important also to get a general picture of the guy's health. Also ask him, how old were your parents when they died? You know, I'll never forget asking a patient that, and he came to me 80 years of old, and he had a 30-year-old wife and a 5-year-old son. And yeah. I said, how old were your parents when they died? And he says, they're in the waiting room. They're alive. They're 105. So you never want to be ageist. People, you know, if you've got about a 10.
That's right. Having an age-related cutoff doesn't make any sense in a society that's both aging and getting healthier as they get older.
It's something that you look at the person and say, is this person going to be around in 10 to 15 years? And if so, could this prostate cancer kill them? And I think that's when you kind of make the decisions about how to go down the road, what to do about it.
So traditionally, we've offered people radical prostatectomy, which we do robotically. Then there are a number of different options that can be done from a radiation standpoint. And we've talked about both of those on the show at great length. Why don't we talk a little bit about active surveillance, watchful waiting, and molecular testing? What do these words mean, and what's their role?
Well, active surveillance, watchful waiting, a lot of times are used interchangeably. But
I had a patient that hated when I said watchful waiting. He was like, no, I went to a doctor that's doing active surveillance.
Really?
I was like, oh, man.
Same thing.
It's the same word. It's just the same thing. I don't like you, Dr. Mystery. I wanted active surveillance, not watchful waiting.
You're right. But I've always thought there was a little bit of a difference.
No.
I mean, just a little bit. Maybe I'm going to do more biopsies to you.
I'll definitely do more biopsies, so don't worry. That's right. I definitely am an active surveillance guy. I'm very active.
So, you know, the point is, you know, for a lot of times, if you're, let's say, a 75, 80-year-old, and you have one positive biopsy, and it's the least aggressive Gleason score, 3+3=6, that you'll see typically. That's a guy who can probably watch it. You know, that's the kind of guy you don't want to say it's like killing a fly with a bazooka gun. You know, we're just going to see what this thing does. And if it starts to turn ugly, then we re-biopsy you and see if now you have a Gleason 8, you know, something much more aggressive, and all your biopsies are positive. So that's what I look at as far as active surveillance. And I think every patient's different, to be honest with you. I don't know if you have a different criteria how you watch these guys.
For everyone, I usually do a PSA every 6 months, and I do a repeat biopsy at a year in everyone. I guess that's just the kind of way that I develop.
Yeah, I think 6 months is standard. I think a lot of times I'll look for the trigger to get me to then say, okay, we didn't see any cancer the first time. Now you got a PSA that's a couple points higher. Now let's do an MRI again, see if anything changed, and then re-biopsy anything that looks suspicious. A lot of times that's the direction I'll go.
And there are not only MRIs, but now we have molecular genetic tests that we can do on the biopsy specimens to tell us not only is it objectively look dangerous to the pathologist, but on a molecular level, do the genes look like this is going to be a more active cancer? And that can help me decide who's a good active surveillance candidate as well.
Yeah, there are three companies at least that offer this. I'm curious what your algorithm is, if there's someone that you say look at. But basically, we're trying to say not just a Gleason score, how many biopsies are positive. What is your, I mean, let's face it, I tell it's like having COVID. We're all going to get COVID. Just don't die of it. So as a man, you know, we're going to get prostate cancer. Just find out which one's going to kill you.
And I would say conventional wisdom tells me that I think our patients out there think that we actually do more tests than we actually do, meaning that they expect us to have a lot more innate knowledge of their disease process than sometimes we're given with a simple pathology report. And I think that we are entering that era of molecular medicine where we're going to have that. So both of us do HIFU, or high intensity focused ultrasound, which is a fourth way to address cancer. So, you know, watchful waiting, radical prostatectomy, radiation therapy, and then now this HIFU therapy. And not very many urologists in the country do this. You and I probably are in a field of about 100 urologists in this country that offer this procedure. What has been your experience with high-intensity focused ultrasound for prostate cancer?
I've been very happy with it. We've been doing it now for about 5 years. I just remember the very first day I did them. I did two. The second guy I did that day went home and ran a 10K the following week after surgery, and, you know, ran a personal best. So, you know, he's a little picture he sent me, and we published it in a running magazine, because just to tell people you can get back on your feet in no time. So it's very useful for those who really just are nervous about watchful waiting, active surveillance, whatever you want to call it.
And that's where I use it. I actually have very few patients on watchful waiting, you know, because we can offer a treatment that is minimally invasive, very quick, has very little downtime, and has very low side effect profile. So risks of impotence and incontinence are very low with high intensity focused ultrasound, especially if it's kind of tailored. And I've been very pleased with it. More and more insurances are paying for it. Our cash pay price is the lowest in the country at $13,500. And although not everybody's a candidate, many people are good candidates for high-intensity focused ultrasound.
Well, people do push the envelope. I think my third patient was a Gleason 8 cancer that had a surgery scheduled with another urologist. And I said, you need to get your prostate out. I agree with him. He goes, oh, no, I'm not getting my prostate
out.
Yes,
because ultimately it's the patient's decision. If they don't want to have it done, they're not going to have it done.
This guy was classic, though. He went to a urologist and said, would you do a Gleason 8 HIFU? And he goes, not only would I do it, I had Gleason 8 cancer and I had it done on me. This patient is now also about 5 years years out with no evidence of disease. So he sends me his Gleason 9 brother. And I go, look, we're pushing our luck here. You know? So yeah, you have to be careful. Not everyone's a candidate, but you know, you'd be surprised.
You'd be surprised at how many are. And we are just about to embark upon a new era in this city. We have the fanciest, most technologically advanced machine. We have the new Focal One HIFU machine that's coming to town. It has MRI guidance capabilities. It is state of the art. This coming week, I'll be doing my first case on a doctor's dad who has an MRI seen lesion, and we're gonna take care of it and ablate it using this HIFU. I'm very excited.
Oh, I'm very excited to hear it too. I mean, it sounds amazing.
And from a recovery standpoint, what are you telling patients on how long it takes to recovery and what are some common post-operative symptoms?
I tell them if I have to treat the whole prostate, I'm probably going to recommend to do a resection or an aquablation, something that's going to open up the inside to minimize their risk of having trouble urinating afterwards. You know, you have to respect that some prostates are big, and if you do it all at once, they're going to have trouble going, and you don't want to do surgery if you can avoid it after the HIFU ablation. If I do one side, a lot of times I tell them, we don't have to. You know, if you don't have any symptoms, we don't have to. But we do send them home with a catheter, usually for about 5 to 7 days, just to make sure that they're going to be fine afterwards. And then, like I said, you're not going to necessarily run a 10K and get a PR from it, but I tell them you can probably be
go back to work and you're going to be just fine.
You can go to work next week. I mean, the day surgery, no admission. I mean, you know, just have to tell them that, yeah, it's a catheter, but it's not 2 weeks.
We love second opinions. Second opinion mystery, mm-hmm. they call me. And I'll give you a third and fourth one if you really want it. Mm-hmm. Coming to us to a visit with Dr. Giacomides about your prostate cancer diagnosis is your first step to get a HIFU. Donna, how do they get a hold of us?
Call us at 512-238-0762.
The Armour Men's Health Show is brought to you by NAU Urology Specialists. For questions or to schedule an appointment, please call 512-238-0762 or online at armormenshealth.com.